Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And our guest this hour is Cheryl Wu Dunn. She's a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. And she's going to be in Madison on Tuesday, June 16, as the guest speaker at the Madison Community Foundation. Also, she'll be earlier in the day in conversation with author David Marinus. She'll be talking about, well, so many subjects because she has a world perspective on a number of issues. Her new book, written with her husband, who's a columnist for the New York Times, Nicholas Kristof, is A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, which looks at how each of us can make a difference. She is the first Asian American reporter to win a Pulitzer. She's a business executive and entrepreneur whose special expertise is Asia, entrepreneurship, global women's issues, and philanthropy. She's the author of three best-selling books, including Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Worldwide, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. Cheryl, hello. Thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Hi, Kathleen. It's a delight to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Well, you certainly have had a lot of lives, haven't you? You're a bestseller author. You're an entrepreneur. You're doing all these things. You're a mom, too. Most importantly.
Well, you know, we all have lots of lives. We just don't follow them, right?
Right. That's true. Or it just takes us a while to get to some. I want to start with your daughter particularly. You wrote an interesting piece that probably was in one of your books, but I read about it in the New York Times, where your daughter had this friend who you were a little worried about, who used to come over and play in the yard all the time, but she came from a very, very troubled background. Her mom was in prison, I think. She was bringing alcohol to sixth grade parties, etc., which created a dilemma for you as a parent. Do I worry about this influence? But you looked at it at a broader level, not really necessarily do I worry about this for my child, but how do we attack the problem that this young woman had?
Yes, there was a young girl, Jessica, who lived right by our farm in Oregon, where we go every summer. It's where Nick grew up and where his mom still lives. And Jessica had always played with our kids, especially my daughter, and we thought, you know, she's a really lively girl. She's, you know, inventive. She's creative. And it was only later that we discovered, oh, my goodness, her background and what she had been facing as she was growing up. Her mother, who we knew just a little bit about, she had actually given birth to Jessica at home. No one knew. She just walked into the bathroom one day and out popped Jessica.
Oh, my gosh.
Unbelievable. And, you know, she was heavy already, the mother, and so people just thought she was gaining more weight. But obviously it was a lot more than that. But Jessica thankfully came out safely. And over the years, we just kept getting little sketches. Oh, well, she's dealing drugs. Or, you know, Jessica had been living with the grandmother. And the grandmother was a really rock-solid woman. You know, she had been through so many trials and tribulations with her daughters, of course. The other daughter was doing fabulously well. So we knew that there was some really good sense in the grandmother. But Jessica was always always very clever and she was a rascal. She would have been in that show, The Rascals, because she was one of the biggest ones. We hadn't realized what she had put up with when she was growing up. Her mother basically didn't feed her. There was a time during middle school where Jessica basically had to steal food from the neighbors because there was no food in the house. Mm. The electric bills were never paid. And so Jessica every night would run around the neighborhood, you know, trying to steal food. One night she was just, you know, it was just unbearable for her. She crawled into the backyard of one of her neighbors with their dog and went to sleep. And the neighbor found her there with the dog and called the police. And then that's when it started coming out what Jessica was up against.
Mm. And so what does that say about how we can help girls particularly, not just all over the world, but in our own backyards with their dogs?
I know. One definitely can help. In fact, what happened was then Jessica was put into foster care, and she found a foster mother who was just wonderful. I mean, there are saints in the world, thankfully, and this woman basically was one of them. She takes a number of kids, and she took in Jessica, and she basically gave Jessica a lot of tough love. She herself had been had a really hard scrabble, you know, life growing up, and so she's kind of knew where Jessica was coming from. Jessica was rebellious. She was, you know, not cooperative. She would argue, and this foster mother wouldn't put up with it and put her foot down and said, you know, you're not wearing, you know, strapless, you know, shirts. You're going to do your homework. You're going to graduate from school. And when Jessica actually found out that she could do homework, she did very well. In fact, in her senior year, she got all A's.
Oh, good for her.
Clearly this, and then she went to college. She clearly is very bright, but she just didn't have the stable environment to apply herself.
Yeah. Sometimes it takes just another person, doesn't it? Your new book, A Path Appears, there's so many wonderful stories. I can't remember the young man's name, but he was thought of as being a slow learner. He was never going to be able to learn. He was put in the hallway, for heaven's sake, and nobody even taught him anything at his school. And all of a sudden, somebody noticed him. Thank goodness for that, because, boy, did he change his life.
Yes, you know, it's funny. So this wonderful man was basically, when he grew up in the Pennsylvania, in a tiny, tiny little town where they don't even have a gas station, and he really was put into the corner and said, and basically told, well, you know, he'll, you know, if he can lead an independent life, you'll be lucky. And he was one of seven, eight kids. His father really only had a third-grade education. His mother was a little bit more educated. But they just, you know, had too many kids running around, so they could never really, manage all of the kids. And so it was very lucky that he actually ended up having three mentors, a barber, the mother of one of his friends, and someone at his church. And they basically told him that he could make it. He could make it. And so he tried, he applied himself. He ended up actually doing so well, graduating at the top of his high school class, getting a scholarship to Davidson College, and becoming an anchor, on the TV, TV news in Boston. And now he's running a nonprofit organization. But it's just remarkable how he was able to turn around. So A Path Appears really is about how there are so many ways that we can create opportunity for kids who we think are underprivileged, who we think are just downtrodden and won't amount to anything. And my goodness, if you just give them a little bit of encouragement and hope, they can soar.
Mm-hmm. In your earlier book, in which you looked at the plight of women around the world, it is remarkable how a small, I'm thinking about the woman that you highlighted in India, who had a horrible home circumstance and had a daughter and her husband wasn't working and they had no money and she had to put her daughter with somebody else so that she could take care of her. And then she's given one of these microloans. These microloans are incredible, aren't they? And tell us the rest of the story.
Right. I think you might be thinking about In Half the Sky, Saima.
Yes.
And she lived in outside Lahore, Pakistan. And she had actually gotten married. She had born a girl. And, of course, in Pakistan, they really do like boys. So there was a strike against her because she had actually given birth to a girl, even though she doesn't have anything to do with the sex that comes from the male, right? But, in fact, there was a village. Someone in the village had come to give some microloans, teach women about how to borrow money and use it productively. It's an organization called CASHT and run by a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people. And so Saima got a little microloan, and she was wondering, what can I do with this? I can't do anything. I'm just this, you know, this lowly woman. Mm-hmm. And she discovered that she's actually good at embroidery. So she started embroidering, and then people started buying it. In fact, then she was so popular, her embroidery was so popular that she needed to hire other people to help her with the embroidery because she couldn't fill all the orders. And finally, when it got so big, she was hiring 30 women in the village to do the embroidery, she realized that, you know, she needed someone to help her transport the stuff from her village to the marketplace. And, you know, none of the men were ever helping. And her husband, in fact, was the one who said, oh, my goodness, maybe I'll get a second wife because, you know, she bore me a daughter. I don't want daughters. I want a son. And he would beat her up. And when she realized that she needed someone who was strong to help her, you know, transport all of the embroidery work to the marketplace, she thought, well, maybe I'll ask my husband. And in fact, he totally did it, and they are now in business together. They are the local tycoons, and obviously her life and the whole family's life and the village life has been turned around.
Yeah. Well, you and Nicholas have traveled the world, and you know these stories of extreme poverty and really horrible conditions for women and not being educated and being subjected to sex trafficking and abusive husbands, etc. It appears to me that instead of being overwhelmed by this, you highlight some of these stories so that people understand them, but you also believe that there are challenges and ways for every human being to be able to significantly change the life of somebody who appears to be beyond hope.
Well, I mean, that's exactly what we have seen. It's not that I think that it's possible. It happens. We see it every day. We've seen it with Jessica, as we just talked about earlier. It is definitely an untapped potential, and that's what's so sorry about it, is that we often, from the outside, think, oh, my gosh, these people are just, you know, useless. But they aren't. You know, talent is universal. Opportunity is not. And what's amazing is that I have seen talent, like, you know, just come out of rocks. I mean, it's just incredible how these people have this amazing talent, and you think that just because they don't come from America, they're not born and raised in the best schools in the world, that they aren't worth anything. You know, I've seen and kids come from refugee camps in Sudan, and they end up at college at Yale University. I mean, these the potential is, for the human potential, is incredible. And so we really shouldn't just close our eyes to, you know, all these poor people and think of them that way. They really have great potential, and we just need to turn on that light and help them so that they can actually do really well.
So how do you navigate the variety of organizations that are around to help give somebody that light? There are many of them. I think some people just feel, I really don't know where to go. I don't know where to give my money. I don't know where to give my help. I don't know what to do.
Well, that's why we wrote A Path Appears, because we actually do suggest a number of organizations that people should look at. You have to do your own research. This is not a screen, but it's a starting place. We actually, you know, depending upon what area you're interested in, I mean, you really have to first ask yourself, okay, do I care about education? Do I care about healthcare? Do I care about things going on in the U.S.? Do I care about things going on in Cambodia or in Kenya? It depends on where you want to put your focus. And once you decide that you want to do something in Kenya, for instance, well, then there are a whole bunch of organizations in Kenya that help with education or healthcare, and we kind of touch on a lot of possibilities. There's also, in the back of the book, there's a list of all these organizations that tell you about what kind of emphasis each of them has. You can start looking at them. But, you know, it sounds like, oh, my gosh, that's so much research. But really, it's kind of an interesting journey. It says if you're going to, you know, take a tour to India, for instance, well, I mean, you have to do research as well. Where to go? This is the same thing. This is where to go, what to do. But it's so fulfilling as well, when you realize that you can actually have a huge impact on someone's life and change their trajectory.
Yeah. And there's something in our nature, most of us, I think, the majority of us, you say early in the book, that not only makes us feel good if we give, that we really want to do that just as a good human being.
Well, there's a number of things that actually can benefit us when we do give and give back and feel compassion and help out. You know, of course, you do feel good. In fact, when you give of yourself, there's a certain part of the brain that is stimulated, because these are all chemical reactions, and it's the same part that is stimulated when you eat chocolate, for instance, or when you flirt, or when you fall in love. It is that pleasure center of the brain. Yes, so when you give back, you are stimulating the pleasure center of the brain, which most people don't know. I mean, they sort of think maybe that's true, but that feeling that you get when you feel happy, when you've helped someone, that's real. That really is. That's something, it's a chemical reaction going on in your brain. There's also some other health benefits as well. They've done lots of different studies, and they've shown that people who actually volunteer and help out for organizations do have better health outcomes than people who don't. So there are studies that actually look, randomized controlled studies that actually look at groups of people who are volunteering and groups who don't, and they look at the, they follow them, they monitor them, and they actually find that those who volunteer actually have healthier outcomes. Mm.
I was interested in the people who give and who gives the most. I was not aware that private giving accounts for a whole lot of the charitable giving in the world, and that we're not first in giving. It's what, Australia is first, Ireland second, or are we second?
Yes. No, we're third. You know, Americans give, individuals give around $300 billion. I mean, you know, it's $300-plus billion a year, and that's a lot. We don't always give very wisely. But we do give, but we're also not the most generous. That belongs to Australians and to Irish people, yes.
Mm-hmm. And is there, I know you deal with this in the book as well, if a lot of people give, if private people give, what about the role of government? And if you have really large private giving, does it keep the government from stepping up to the plate?
Oh, no. I mean, it should certainly shouldn't. I mean, we don't, I mean... To bring about change, to actually change society, it takes everyone. It takes, you know, a world to bring about change. There's no one person, there's no one organization, there's no one group of people who can actually, you know, move the needle so much that the world changes its trajectory. You really do need everyone. You need the government playing a role because they have to set policy, they have to create laws, they have to enforce those laws. They are the best ones to help with education. To roll out curriculum nationwide, certainly in other parts of the world, as well as in the U.S., you also need, you know, corporations. They certainly can play a role. They're huge. They potentially huge because they have a lot more financial clout, and they also use business practices and sustainable practices that can actually even become more sustainable with the kind of programs that they develop than some of the NGOs. And then, of course, you have NGOs, and they, as a group, also can bring about a great deal of change. And you have foundations. People have to all, whatever their background is, wherever their influence is, they should leverage that influence to try and make a difference.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll do that in a moment. Cheryl Wu Dunn is our guest this hour. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She's going to be in Madison on June 16 as the guest speaker at the Madison Community Foundation. And there will also be a conversation with David Marinus about her new book, A Path of Peers, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity, that is co-written with her husband, New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. They met each other. I believe that's how they met, at the New York Times, both as correspondents. She worked for the Times for quite a while, and she is now a business executive and entrepreneur. We're looking at giving, and we're also, because she has done a great deal of work on women and girls and global poverty and extremism, and she believes that the best way to take on the issue of global poverty, which is significant, and extremism, which is significant, is to focus on women and girls. And we'll talk more about that during the course of this hour. The book, the latest one, is just filled with stories of, tell the story of this young 9-year-old girl who started this incredible charity, and was a horrible tragedy happened to her, but the charity went on. Other people who have just decided that something happened within them, or they saw something and they really wanted to help in a major way and have done so. Many of you listening help. I know you do, and you may want to talk about your personal stories of help, or you have questions about where you can help, or how do you navigate the whole charitable giving worldwide scene. Are there causes that are most near and dear to you? There are suggestions for all kinds of charities in this book. We welcome your phone calls, and here's how you reach us: 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. We're talking about a number of issues with Cheryl Wu Dunn. The latest book that she co-authored with her husband, Nicholas Kristof, is A Path Appears, Transforming Lives and Creating Opportunity. And let's start our calls with Sharon in Oshkosh. Hi, Sharon. Hi, Sharon.
Oh, hi. I'm sorry. I thought I got cut off. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello to your guest, Cheryl.
Hi, Sharon.
Hi, I'm calling, it's a grassroots kind of a story, just in that I had a little girl who was 8 years old who came to the door and wanted to, well, actually, she didn't come to the door. She found me walking my two dogs, and she wanted a job, and she wondered if she could, you know, help walk the dogs or help out and make some money, because they wanted to go to sawdust days, and her mother told her she had to go make some money. So I thought this was so entrepreneurial that I had to give her a chance. So she came over, and we got her set up where she could feed the dogs while I was at work and my husband was at work. And with her mother, she set herself up so that she could have a key and she'd come in and she'd feed the dogs and brush them and make $10 each time. So we thought she was such a little brain, and she really was. She is. One of the things, though, that started to occur to me was that, first of all, she's terribly thin. Her mother is, too, and I see her mother at times. And once or twice, we'd walk around the block, and she'd want to check on her mother to see if her mother was okay. Mm. And that put some alarms off in my head. And then she'd come over, and she would say, "Oh, that pizza smells so good." And she was hungry. Mm. So my husband and I would feed her a couple of times, you know, send her off with almonds and snack bars and things. I still wonder what I can do in knowing that a neighbor might not be able to care for her children, and if I can do more. I know she's going to come over more and more. I mean, I know I have the phone number, and she can call her up, and she's going to come and sit with the dogs some more. But something isn't good, and I don't really know what else I can do. You know, I can feed her when she's here. I just can't see you knocking on a door and saying, "Is everything okay, Mrs. Smith?" But I don't know. Is there anything else I can do?
Right. Those are always really tricky situations. I think that there are a couple things. One is, I do think that it's really important to teach her survival skills, how she can learn how to fish rather than just giving her fish. So it's great that you're giving her food, but the most important thing that you are teaching her already is entrepreneurship and how she can, you know, continue in school.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, also emphasis on education.
Yeah.
The second is, if you do know of, I mean, a local organization that her mother might be able to go to, that's a possibility as well.
And bring it forward.
Right. That's another introduce her to a local organization. But I do think that the emphasis that you can put on to her in terms of entrepreneurship and education, because education is going to be her way out.
Yeah. She's super brilliant, and she likes to brag about how she's going to get ahead in school because she's moving right into fifth grade and skipping forth. That's so great. I do want to say also, your program made me wonder about President Obama's daughters. And I so hope to see them making inroads for girls. And I'm excited to see them do so, don't you think? And don't you think
that? Absolutely. I do think that because they can shine a spotlight on some of these issues the way Michelle Obama has.
Yeah.
I think it's really important. I know that Michelle Obama has you know, done a lot as well. And I do think that her daughters can do a lot.
Yeah, just like Chelsea Clinton is, and I'm so excited to see them grow up and see what they'll do. Everybody, you know, has their own life to live, and I understand that, but I'll bet you there'll be something we'll see with those girls. So, well, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question.
Listening. Yep.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. Well, that's quite a story. Sometimes it's right in our neighborhood, isn't it, Cheryl?
Right. Right. And that's what's great, is that she reached out and she actually did respond. And hopefully she will have, and I think she is already having a very positive impact on that girl.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sharon, so much for your call. Dave is next in Appleton. Hi, Dave.
Hello. My daughter-in-law is in your book, actually, Devin Hibbert.
Oh, my.
Yeah, she does.
I'm sorry, who?
Devin Hibbert, Bead for Life.
Ah. Oh, excellent. Of course.
Yeah. Well, she would get mad at me if I didn't call in and ask you to give a plug for that group, probably.
Tell us
about it. Great organization, Beads for Life.
Yeah, tell us about it, Dave.
Well, it's women in Uganda that has been going on. She and her mother started it about 12 years ago, and now Devin is in charge. But they make beads. They roll up paper from magazines and so forth. And it started out just to build enough money for them to build little houses for themselves. And now it's expanded into more of an education kind of thing for kids, for girls. So it's a great organization.
And what I like about Beads for Life, is that, it's not just a charity purchase. I mean, one of the things that is really important is for the people in Uganda, women to create jewelry. They make jewelry out of beads, basically, to make jewelry that the market wants, so that people who are buying it here in the U.S., they aren't just doing it out of charity. They're doing it because they like it, because it's the market and it's the sustainable market enterprise that is actually going to enrich the lives of those Ugandan women. And that's what I like about it a lot.
Mm. And let's talk more about, because this takes in another huge area, more the focus of another of your books, that if we're going to look at poverty in the world, which is a huge issue, if we're going to look at extremism in various countries, we should focus on women and girls. That's the most effective way to fight both of those.
Larry Summers once said, when he was chief economist at the World Bank, that the greatest return on your investment in the developing world is girls' education. It is partly because there is a huge challenge of discrimination to death in many ways against women and girls in many parts of the developing world. And girls, there's been a huge progress. Girls are doing very well in terms of elementary school education. They need to make more progress in terms of getting through secondary school, high school, sometimes middle school, the way they count the secondary school education. And then, of course, if they can get to college, that's even better. But the discrimination can really end up killing these girls. They're trafficked, as you mentioned earlier, Kathleen. They can be trafficked. They're not treated in terms of health care when women get pregnant. They're not taken to the clinics. They often are married off at a very, very young age, and then they start having kids when they're 14. So, what kind of education can they get? So the key thing is really to try and educate the girls alongside boys so that the boys can see that girls can grow up smart, intelligent, knowledgeable, and they can contribute to society as productive members.
Mm-hmm. You write about, you were at Tiananmen Square, and you write about standing on the edge of that square watching troops fire automatic weapons, but also what was also going on in China, 39,000, we don't know about this, baby girls dying annually because parents didn't give them the same medical care and attention that boys received, and that was just in the first year of life. You write about Indian bride burning that takes place. There's this whole perception in some parts of the world that girls simply aren't as valuable. How do you deal with that kind of cultural perception? How does that change, Cheryl?
It is changing, and it changes with attitudinal change, and the way you change attitudes is through education. It's a long process. It's not going to be changed overnight, but there are, we see what happened, in Pakistan. We've seen what happens in India. With all of these situations where girls are being challenged, they're being shot at, so they don't go to school. And it's certain factors of society who don't want women to get ahead, who don't want women to even go to school because they know that a girl with a book is actually quite powerful. But we do have to, fight against these forces because they're very destructive to society. And research has shown that when women are on the marginal sides, parts of society, when they are marginalized and not in the mainstream, when there are only men, especially if they're young men, left in the mainstream of society, there's a lot more violence. That's just not a good society to be in. It is not a productive society.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Josh in Madison next. Hi, Josh.
Hello. Hi. I have a question here. Recently, I was given the opportunity to do some work for an organization in Sierra Leone, and I got a taste of humanitarian work, and I fell in love with it. And I want to know how can one make a living out of humanitarian work? My profession isn't really related to the humanities at all. So where can I go? What can I do? The organization that I was working for, West African Medical Mission, very small, very new, but revolutionary organization. And I have, just a side note, I have a feeling that the smaller organizations are the ones doing the best work on the ground. But they don't hire folks. It's the larger ones that do. And how can I get into that world?
Well, first of all, what do you currently do? May I ask what your profession is?
Electronics engineering.
Oh, okay. Because I would argue that, in fact, you know, you can mix and match. In many ways, a lot of NGOs really need the skill set that you have, and they don't have it. So they all actually need people who are well steeped in these industries because they've got skills, they've got the latest skills that they don't have access to. So whether you can get onto the board of the organization and volunteer on a more regular basis, that's one way that you can really help them. I also think that a lot of NGOs, because some of the small ones live hand-to-mouth, they don't have necessarily, I don't know how this one supports itself, but, you know, building donations is really difficult. And I don't think that's the only way to organize, you know, the kind of humanitarian work that you were talking about. Sometimes through social enterprise, where you can build a sustainable effort. I'm not exactly sure what this NGO does. Maybe it does health relief, or I'm not sure. But I think that if there's any way that social enterprise can be brought into the approach, that makes it more sustainable, so that they don't always have to rely on donations. And it also imposes a certain kind of discipline on some of these organizations to try and improve the way they operate. But I just don't know enough about this particular organization to say how you could actually help them more. But there are large organizations that do excellent work. It's harder to work if you've been in the private sector to move into the nonprofit sector, so you'd want to be very careful about it because they're, they just operate differently, and so you'd want to find one that you would feel comfortable with because there's also the bureaucracy side of things.
Oh, isn't that true? It's everywhere. There's a bureaucracy always. What about his point that the smaller organization he tended to feel, maybe it's just the field, you get to know people better and you can see more what you're doing. Can large organizations be just as effective as the smaller humanitarian organizations? And how do you know?
I do think they can be just as effective and sometimes more effective, but also sometimes less effective. It just really depends on the organization. And who's running it and what its mission and what its guiding principles are. So I think it's really hard to generalize. I mean, there are not that many large nonprofit organizations. I mean, if you look at startups, if you looked at a startup NGO versus startups, for-profit, many more of the for-profit startups, and mind you, it's hard to break out of being a startup in any fashion, but more of them break out of the $50 million budget size than NGOs. There are not too many NGOs that can expand beyond the $50 million size. And, you know, there are a number of reasons why that's hard, certainly scaling efficiently is difficult, and it does tend, you know, they don't have the systems, the operational capacity that a lot of companies will have. And so it does get, I wouldn't say bureaucratic, but it just takes longer to have things done because everything sometimes is
right.
All the decisions are made at the very top.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Josh. All the best to you. I think it's wonderful when somebody realizes this is what I really want to do, and I can do this.
Yeah, no, yeah, it's wonderful.
It's great. Thanks for the call. Richard in Madison, hi.
Hi. I have a question. Nigeria has the richest economy in Africa. Yet Boko Haram is abducting girls. Right offshore, we have big oil making lots of money in Nigeria. How do you leverage big oil to help Nigerian girls?
Well, that's a great question. You should pose it to the oil companies. Mm-hmm. Exxon, I believe, has some operations there. I'm not sure. I do think that oil companies are beginning to realize that there is a business case for them to really help out with the local communities. They tend to focus on the local communities where they have the operations because they want to draw labor. They want to draw workers from a stable environment. They want to make sure that the families, are very stable as well. So they tend to focus on the communities where they actually are doing the work. Sometimes they do go outside of that. But as to Boko Haram and the girls, I mean, that's a really big challenge, and the government does have to take it more seriously and try and figure out a way to really control that terrorist organization. I mean, it's, hopefully this new regime in Nigeria will do a better job. I mean, it's being led by a former military general.
Thank you, Richard, very much for your call. Dennis in Richland Center. Hi.
Hello. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to touch on a couple of things that you talked about. One is how you get into humanitarian or nonprofit work, and the other is the social side of it. I mean, as far as the business side of it is what I mean. We're in the process of starting a nonprofit ourselves. I'll try and keep my story real short here. My wife has lymphoma, and after her diagnosis and treatment, there was a very pretty long period that she was through some serious depression. You do everything that you can for cancer, and then there's a point where you just have to wait and see what happens. And in her talking to a lot of people, we've found that that's pretty common, and we've talked to a lot of doctors and stuff. And what worked for her was about 6 months after she was done with the treatments, we went to Puerto Rico for the first time, and after a week or 10 days there, her mood was completely different.
Huh.
She got out of her normal daily routine into a tropical environment. This was during January, so that helped a lot.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And what we did, we ended up buying property and building a cabin there so that we can go back often. Huh. And every time we do it, picks your spirits up again.
Hmm.
And we rent our cabin out now, which pays for it, of course. And we've started offering free stays to cancer survivors so that they can experience that same thing.
Huh.
So as a result of that, how well it's been going, we're starting our own nonprofit, building a little lodge and rental cabins. And by renting at about 50%, we'll be able to provide free stays for cancer survivors on a bigger scale than what we're doing now. So it's kind of a combination of a business and a nonprofit, but it's self-supporting that way. You know, we don't have to go out looking for money all the time just for daily operations. So.
Oh, I love that. I mean, I think that's exactly the kind of creative ways. And I'm so glad that your wife is in a better place now. That's just wonderful to hear. And it clearly, it grew out of something that was, horrible. But now what a creative and,
yes.
And very positive thing to have created. That's wonderful to hear. Thank you for sharing that.
And to think of somebody else, that it brightened her spirits, so the thought was, well, it'll brighten somebody else's spirits as well.
Yeah, she wants to pay it forward. That's fabulous. fabulous.
Yeah,
that's fabulous.
Very nice. Thank you very much, Dennis, for your call. We're welcoming more phone calls. Our guest this hour is Cheryl Wu Dunn. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Her latest book, co-authored with her husband, Nicholas Kristof, is A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunities, and it highlights people all over the world whose lives have been transformed thanks to the help of other human beings. She is the author of a number of other best-selling books, Half the Sky, Turning Oppression into Opportunity for Women Around, for Women Worldwide, which is about the challenges that are facing women all over the world. And she is also co-author of China Wakes. She worked at the New York Times as a business reporter and editor and foreign correspondent in Tokyo and Beijing. Here's how you reach our conversation. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And you can also find us on Twitter, and that's at Kay Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcoming phone calls. If you want to join our conversation, we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Cheryl Wu Dunn is our guest this hour. I want to start with some more, because I don't know where you found all of these people, but there are some just moving stories in your latest book. And you start with this story of Rachel Beckwith, which will stay with me, Cheryl, for a long time, because it is so inspirational, and at the same time, it is so sad.
Yes, Rachel was just a delightful girl. I mean, she was only 8 when she happened to hear that a lot of people in parts of Africa don't have clean water. They don't have access to clean water. They have to walk miles and miles twice a day just to carry water back so they can eat, you know, make food. And so she wanted to raise money to help dig wells, and she did it through Charity Water, which is a wonderful organization that helps, you know, raise money for organizations that actually dig wells in parts of Africa. And so she said, I'm going to start a birthday campaign. Charity Water allows you to create these birthday campaigns where instead of giving people presents, they actually donate, you know, the money goes to places like these organizations that actually dig the wells. And she set as her goal $300. Towards a few days before her 9th birthday, it didn't look like she was going to make it. But then her family got into a car accident, and Rachel was critically injured and rushed off to the hospital. And as she was in the hospital in a coma, and, you know, they put out on social media, Charity Water did, that, you know, she's really, really ill. And then people wanted to show their sympathy and you know, hopes that she'll recover, and they started donating to her birthday fundraiser, mostly in $9 increments, but they would, you know, raise money. They actually sent money there. And she started raising money, like thousands of dollars. I mean, she went up to like $50,000. That would have broke the record that had been set by Justin Bieber. And so her mom was able to whisper in her ear that she had broken that record. Well, Rachel unfortunately didn't make it. And that was heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. When social media got hold of that, people just felt awful, and there was an outpouring of sympathy. Again, people started sending money to her birthday fundraiser, and Rachel raised $50,000, $100,000, some huge amount of money. She ended up raising more than $1 million, and it was just incredible that this little girl, her life could actually draw such attention. And her mom, a year later, went to Uganda, where they actually had drilled some wells. And the villagers who actually, were benefiting from it, met Rachel's mom and just showed their appreciation. They just felt, on the one hand, so grateful that they had gotten this water, but also so sad that it came at the expense of poor Rachel's life. But her mom, Samantha, realized that in the end, Rachel's life really was so worthwhile.
look what she had done to bring water to 30,000 people who never had clean water before. It was just, it made her really think carefully about what she wants to accomplish in her life as well,
right.
And what we all want to accomplish in our life.
Right. And you see those stories on the news from time to time of children who are taking on these remarkable causes, which made me wonder and want to ask you, what about exposing our children to giving? It, obviously, not everybody's going to be like Rachel or like some of these people who are featured, but should we be teaching our children to save so much money from an allowance or whatever to give to others?
I think it's that's definitely a certain component about it. I mean, but it's not just money, the money aspect. It's also just raising people to be more compassionate
mm-hmm.
and more engaged in society, because our society will only get better if we're all engaged and we all try to make it a better place. It sounds really corny, but, you know, when you think about, you know, what you want your epitaph to read, what do you want it to say? Do you want it to say that, oh, I made a lot of money? Or do you want it to say, yes, I really helped a lot of people? And I think that really is quite chilling. I mean, it's a not a great piece of advice to give to someone. You know, think about what you want to have read on your epitaph, and then you know work backwards. But it's actually not terrible advice either.
No, it's not terrible advice, and it does. It's a worthwhile thing to do. Tell me a little bit about your life. You grew up in China?
No, I didn't. I actually am a Chinese American, born and raised in New York City. But we did live in China for 5 years and covered all walks of China. And we were there at a time where the transformation was remarkable. And it also, it has had an impact on the way I look at things. And so I've seen how China didn't use aid to actually develop economically. Basically, it was capitalism that lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And so the kind of mechanism that I think can really help people move out of poverty is, again, it's the market mechanism and being able to help yourself rather than take aid as a principle.
Mm-hmm. And isn't it remarkable that you've been able to work with your husband on all of these books and to take on the whole world?
Oh, I wouldn't say we'd take on the whole world.
Well, you write
heavens.
About the whole world.
Yeah. You know, it's people laugh that, you know, we start with China and then we go to Asia with our second book and then we take on the world with our last two.
Right.
I do think that it's much easier to work with your husband on a book than it is to raise kids. So if you can raise kids together, then you can do just about anything.
I'm with you on that one. It's a very hard thing to do to raise kids, isn't it? But it's the best thing in the world as well. Well, everybody looks forward to your being in Madison. And thank you very much for being with us and taking on the world for an hour.
Thank you so much, Kathleen.
Cheryl Wu Dunn, the latest book that she co-authored with Nicholas Kristof, the New York Times columnist, is A Path Appears, Transforming Lives and Creating Opportunity. They also are the authors of the New York Times bestseller Half the Sky, and brought to light in that book all the struggles faced by women and girls all over the globe. And they also showcase these fascinating stories of individuals who are doing remarkable things to help other human beings. She's going to be in Madison on June 16. David Marinus, who's a fine, fine writer himself, will be conducting a conversation with Cheryl on Tuesday, June 16, from 3 until 4 at Monona Terrace. And then the dinner, the Madison Community Foundation annual dinner, will be from 5 until 8 with a book signing. And that will be at the Monona Terrace, same place, Community and Convention Center. Okay. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We talk about Ty Cobb tomorrow during this hour with the author of A Terrible Beauty. Charles Learson will be joining us. He spent a lot of time and found Ty Cobb that defied the stories that had been thought of concerning Ty Cobb previously. So that's tomorrow during this hour. News ahead, and thank you very much for listening.